From the Moan Broadcast Center, it's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Libby Denkman, in for Larry Mantle today. Kamala Harris made a big statement about her presidential ambitions in Oakland on Sunday. We'll examine her policy proposals and what lane she's staking out against the other 2020 contenders. Plus, the shutdown is over, but a new round of congressional budget negotiations is just beginning. What to expect coming up on Air Talk, right here on 89.3 KPCC.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering an evening master's in clinical psychology program with an MFT. Priority deadline to apply is February 18th at gsep.pepperdine.edu.
It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Good morning. I'm Libby Denkman, in for Larry Mantle today. Thanks so much for being with us. Thousands of furloughed federal workers are back on the job today, now that the 35-day partial government shutdown is over. President Trump on Friday agreed to open the government back up, signing a measure to fund several departments through February 15th. And acting White House Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney was on Fox News Sunday defending the president against charges, mainly from the right, that he caved to House Speaker Nancy Pelosi.
This is just the next step in the negotiation. We thought it was the exact right thing for the president to do at the time. And I think ultimately he'll be judged by the end of by what happens at the end of this process, not by what happened this week.
And Mulvaney reiterated the president needs border security in whatever agreement Congress comes up with. And that includes some type of barrier. Mulvaney also kept the White House's options open, saying in multiple news outlets that President Trump could still declare a national emergency to build a border wall or allow another government shutdown if Congress can't reach a deal. However, Republican Senator Susan Collins of Maine was on CBS's Face the Nation yesterday, pouring cold water on that strategy.
The best agreement that we can get is an agreement on border security, but an agreement to fund federal government through the end of the fiscal year, which is September 30th. No more short-term stopgap funding measures. And we cannot have the threat of a government shutdown hanging over our people and our economy. I know, and I hope he will join us and expect that he will. And working very hard during this next 21 days to prevent us from being back in the same situation.
And Senator Collins was speaking with Margaret Brennan of CBS News there. So what's next on this legislative roller coaster? We turn our politics roundtable every Monday on Air Talk. And up first, we have Lynn Vavreck, professor of political science at UCLA, on the line with us. And if you want to follow her, she tweets at Vavreck, V-A-V-R-E-C-K. Professor Vavreck, thanks so much for being on Air Talk today.
You're welcome.
I just wanted to, you know, first get your sense of that exchange that I played in the intro. Mick Mulvaney trying to keep options open for the future of these negotiations, possibly declaring an emergency, the president, or allowing another shutdown. But then, you know, a more centrist senator like Susan Collins saying, we just don't want that threat hanging over these negotiations if this conference committee is going to be successful. What's your take on the way this goes forward?
Well, I think we always want to be careful predicting what's going to happen in Washington, especially when the president is involved. But it seems like what you're hearing from everyone is nobody wants to shut the government down again. It was just an unpleasant experience, certainly horrible for the people it affected financially, but for everyone. So I think that those legislators are going to work very hard to try to come to a position that is acceptable in some way to everyone, then the question is, what will the president do? And then when you think about his choices, he probably doesn't want to shut the government down again either. He has sort of been blamed for the first one. His approval rating took a hit. There's no reason why he should want to repeat that. So having closed that first chapter, I think he'll look for a different way forward, which means either signing the bill, that comes out of conference, or doing this through some sort of executive action and declaring the emergency. But I don't think the government shutdown is what he'll go for.
Nancy Pelosi has said she's been clear on a border wall. Lynn Vavreck with UCLA, do you expect some type of movement then during the conference committee that gives the president something resembling a border wall, maybe in not so much a name, that allows him to save face and end up signing what comes out of that committee?
So this is really hard. And it's one of these moments, I think, that is easy for everyone who doesn't think about politics day to day to appreciate the difficulty that is always present in Washington when people agree on a goal. We want to have better border control and security, but they don't agree on the best way to get there. That's what politics is all about. How do we resolve that difference? In this case, the president has made it very hard for people to come together to give up a little bit of what they want and care about so that that goal, we can take one small step toward that goal. How did he make that more difficult? This issue has always been political, obviously. It's always been about race and ethnicity. But when he raises the rhetoric and starts using language like the people coming here are not good people, Mexican, they're not sending their best, and all of the rhetoric he used in the campaign and then continues to use in his presidency, he takes this issue and highly racializes it. It's always about race, but in this case, he really turns up the volume, which leads Nancy Pelosi then to respond by saying this is not a political issue. It's a moral crisis. Now, because of that racialization, both sides are a little bit stuck. So this will be very difficult for the legislators in this conference committee to navigate. And what they have to do is find a way forward. Perhaps it's this what I'm calling a drone wall, or I think there are people who really know what that
wall
is are calling it a smart wall. You know, maybe that's what we're doing, but they are going to have to be very creative because of how this issue has pivoted from being about border security to being literally about the question of what does it mean to be an American and how do we think about people who are coming to this country?
Lonnie Chen is also on the line with me, research fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University. He was an advisor for Marco Rubio's 2016 presidential campaign, and he served as policy director for the Romney-Ryan 2012 campaign. Welcome, Lonnie. Always good to have you on the show. And I just want you to react to what Lynn just said. Kind of take me into this room where the House and Senate Conference Committee will be trying to hammer out a deal. It is in the midst of this heated rhetoric, as Professor Vavreck mentioned. What do you think their steps will be to actually reach some sort of compromise that the president will sign before the 15th?
Well, it seems like the deal is relatively straightforward. The elements of the deal, the policy elements of the deal, whether you're talking about border security on the one hand, on the other hand, kind of ways of helping the population of folks roughly known as the DACA recipients, people who were brought to the United States as undocumented immigrants by their parents when they were generally below the age of 18. I think the elements of the deal are relatively straightforward. The question really is semantics and terminology. What is the president willing to accept to satisfy what he wants, which is some kind of physical barrier, but obviously this has proven to be a sticking point. So are we going to, you know, come back to essentially some money for border security, and some of that might plausibly be used to shore up some element of the southern border, whether that's going to be acceptable to the president on the one hand, and on the other hand, kind of how far Nancy Pelosi, Chuck Schumer, the Democrats want to take it in terms of insisting that the president not be able to use any of that terminology in describing elements of the deal. It seems that what we've come down to is not a policy conflict, but a conflict over words and a conflict over how certain elements of this deal are going to be described. I don't think there's anything particularly new about the debate we're having. having. But obviously, the question is going to be, how much is the president going to insist on? How much are the speaker and the minority leader of the Senate going to insist on? And whether those are going to be stumbling blocks to achieving a deal here over the next 3 weeks. The fundamental dynamics aren't going to change a whole lot over these few weeks. So,
I mean, the fundamental dynamics haven't changed since December when, you know, the Mitch McConnell was able to get a budget deal through, but the president decided at the last minute not to sign it. I mean, at what point do those dynamics change? And if you're, you know, saying we're down to just choosing the language of what type of barrier we're using, and I'm hearing, you know, steel slats, I'm hearing the smart barrier thrown around as well. That still leaves us in a position where Pelosi is saying no way, no wall, and the president is saying that's the only way forward. I mean, at what point does somebody bend here?
Well, this is precisely the question, is whether either side will end up bending. I mean, look, I think both sides have backed themselves into a strange corner. You have the Democrats now saying that there is absolutely no moral a case to be made for a fiscal barrier at the southern border when many of them, including the last two Democratic presidential nominees of their party, have supported some kind of money for border security, including a physical barrier, so that the Democrats have boxed themselves into a strange position where they oppose policies that they've generally supported for many years. And on the Republican side, you essentially have them holding things up just for the sake of terminology, for the sake of whether, in fact, money will go toward a fiscal barrier. So I don't see where either side necessarily bends unless they achieve the political reality, which is that a shutdown is not a good look. Another shutdown will not be a good look for either party. And so there is some political motivation to get something done. That's really the only factor that can drive change here.
Lynn Vavreck is on the line with us from UCLA. What do you think the president has to show after this shutdown? You know, centrists saw a lot of working people, including members of the military, the Coast Guard, hurting without paychecks for a month. The Ann Coulters of the world on the other side are mad that the president didn't keep pushing for the wall and called him, you know, something like the biggest wimp that's ever been in the White House. After 35 days of shutting down the government, what did the president end up with?
Well, I think that the end of the shutdown is the really important part of this particular moment, that it's over and now the White House can move forward onto perhaps something else to draw attention to, or whatever comes out of conference hopefully is acceptable and they can claim victory in some way. But I think that thinking about it in terms of the shutdown has hurt the president or hurt the White House in some fundamental way that is going to still matter in 2020, I think that's a mistake. The only common thread that I see sort of happening throughout the entire Trump administration is one about chaos, and whether it's chaos in the outside world that the administration is saying we need to address, trust us to fix this, or whether it's chaos internally in the White House in which other people are saying there's too much chaos there, we need to replace these guys. This is the only thing that I think this shutdown will remain relevant toward, how much chaos is there in the White House.
Lonnie Chen, do you want to weigh in on the way that this ripples maybe to 2020? And that kind of dovetails with something I'm going to bring up in a second, the wider field for 2020. What does this shutdown situation mean in terms of what people will remember in the next year and a half?
Yeah, I don't know that it's going to be all that impactful when we talk about 2020. I mean, there's always this sense that, you know, shutdown politics are going to matter a lot in a presidential cycle. And, you know, one point is certainly the amount of time we have between now and when voters will go to the polls in 2020. I mean, this is we're talking about an eternity. And the other issue is, you know, it is certainly on people's minds when it's going on. But there are many more things that tend to intervene when and before voters go and make these decisions. And frankly, there will be many and other issues that are going to rise to the forefront of their attention that the shutdown, I think, will fade to a distant memory. So I'm not convinced this is going to have a whole lot of long-term lasting impact at all.
What about Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy's idea he said yesterday on one of the Sunday shows that he wants to prevent future shutdowns by passing a bill to stop paying Congress if government funding lapses. I guess Senator Mark Warner has a bill along those lines. Any credence to that idea, Lonnie Chen? Any chance, A, of that passing, and B, that that would actually cause more compromise to break out across Washington?
Well, it's a great messaging piece for both parties to be able to say, look, we shouldn't get paid if we can't come to an agreement on how to keep the government open. I mean, I think that's something that most Americans would say, oh, that sounds relatively common sense. Whether it in fact would motivate changes in behavior on this account, I'm more skeptical of. I mean, certainly after a certain period of time, members of Congress are not going to appreciate not getting paid. But fundamentally, this doesn't erase the level of bitter division and disagreement that exists between the two parties and between members of the two parties now. So it sounds great, but I'm not convinced it's going to do a whole lot of good in the long run.
We're talking with Lynn Vavreck from UCLA, and you just heard Lonnie Chen, a research fellow at the Hoover Institution. It's the Politics Roundtable on Air Talk here on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Libby Dankman in for Larry Mantle today. Coming up next, we're going to tackle this new immigration policy that's taking effect this week. It has to do with asylum seekers and whether they can stay in the United States. We'll talk about it after this short news break with Hedy Lynn Hurdies. Back with more Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Libby Denkman in for Larry Mantle. He's taking the day off. We'll hear from Hedy Lynn Hurdies in just a few minutes, a little early for a news break. We are talking politics with our weekly roundtable. Lynn Vavreck, professor of political science at UCLA, and Lonnie Chen, a research fellow at the Hoover Institution. And I'm looking at this new immigration policy, Lynn Vavreck, that's taking effect this week. I think it may have impact on the congressional negotiations going on and then also the wider conversation about how we treat people that want to come into the United States. The Trump administration is starting what it calls migrant protection protocols. It was first announced on December 20th, and it means the U.S. government will now return non-Mexican migrants who cross the southern border back to wait in Mexico while their asylum requests are processed in U.S. immigration courts. Of course, normally asylum seekers are granted the right to stay in the U.S., but right now there's this huge backlog of immigration cases, and the Trump administration wants to push people out to wait for their cases to process in Mexico. What do you make of this new policy, and will it have the kind of public attention and ripple effect as something like family separations did?
Well, I think it's helpful to break it down into two component parts as we think about it. The first is the actual implementation or operationalization of the policy. And the second is the idea of it and how people will talk about it. And I'm not sure, I thought about this a lot this morning. I'm not sure which of these two things is going to be sort of the most difficult and the most inflammatory, if you will, or attention getting going forward. The implementation part of it could be quite complicated. If you think back to the first travel ban that the White House tried to execute, and the people actually doing it didn't really understand how it was supposed to be done.
There's a lot of confusion in terms of the immigration protocols, and then also, you know, people who were already planning on traveling, whether they were able to come in, and people with green cards. It was just, yeah, like you said, just a ton of confusion.
Exactly. So I think that this situation has the potential to be like that first travel ban. So that's the implementation part of it potentially going badly, which, again, will reflect on the White House and this idea of there's chaos in there, who's in control. That will be bad for the White House. That's separate from that is the idea of the policy. And that, you know, will, I'm sure, be a part of the rhetoric going forward for Donald Trump in 2020, and echoes this question, what does it mean to be an American? Are we going to open our arms to people who are struggling and suffering, or are we going to keep those people out? And in this case, there's a story about why we're holding them But that's going to sound different to different people depending on your ideological proclivities.
Lonnie Chen with the Hoover Institution. What about the effects of this new policy? And do you expect it to be challenged in the courts? It seems like something that will be, on the radar of the ACLU or other immigration rights groups and possibly, stuck in legal limbo for a while.
I do think that there will be considerable legal challenge to this. Obviously, there are a number of legal questions that are triggered by a policy like this, not the least of which is a question regarding whether, in fact, the administration has proper legal authority to implement a policy of this sort, or whether, in fact, this would require congressional approval and statutory change to allow for this to happen. I don't know that this is going to have the same measure of impact on public opinion and on public impressions of the president as the forced separation policy did for some time. I think the question becomes how the different sides spin it. Now, for the president, this is all part of a piece. He sees immigration as an issue that is absolutely vital to his reelection in 2020. And if he's unable to control the immigration issue, certainly with respect to his base of support, he views that as an existential threat to reelection. And so that's why this is all part of a broader strategy to emphasize immigration issues, the wall, this change to asylum policy. These are all parts of the grander strategy, if you will, that the president and his reelection team have put in place.
I've been hearing it referred to by various political commentators on Twitter and elsewhere that something like this shutdown controversy was the president possibly losing a battle, but overall winning a war, which is staking out his position as the America First candidate once again and showing folks who's this is a very important issue to his base that he is committed to fighting for border security, for this wall, to keep folks out of the United States. So, Lonnie, what I'm hearing you say, too, is all of this is a lot of messaging and positioning as well as real policy change.
Yeah, there's no question for Donald Trump. I mean, this immigration issue on the policy merits is something that he has clearly staked a claim to. And then there's also the notion of what the president's character is or how his supporters view him. They want to view him as a doer, as someone who accomplishes things. And if he's unable to make progress on the single issue that he spoke most frequently about during the 2016 campaign, which was to build a wall and to get tough on immigration policy, if he's unable to make progress on those things, it's going to be tremendously damaging to his image. I mean, you already see some fracturing of the right-wing media on this question. For example, you had Ann Coulter, a conservative talk radio host, lambasting the president for essentially capitulating to Speaker Pelosi.
She called him a wimp.
Yeah. So I think you're already starting to see some elements of breaking down of the president's base of support, and I think they're very concerned about that breaking down further.
The horse race riding is, of course, going strong as we look into the future and 2020 right around the corner. Professor Vavrick with UCLA, I know you don't like to get your crystal ball out, but after looking at this, Maggie Haberman and Jonathan Martin of The New York Times had this piece kind of speculating that all of this chaos may have stirred up the ambitions of some candidates on the right to run against the incumbent president, looking at his approval ratings, looking at the midterm elections that the president, his party at least, Republicans lost big in Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin. The Koch brothers network saying that they won't support him again this cycle. Some of the never Trumpers are even trying to get Larry Hogan, the governor of Maryland, to challenge the president for the nomination. Again, horse race gossip, but is there any legitimacy in terms of a threat to the president's reelection bid in 2020?
I think one of the things that you can take away from both the candidates emerging in the Democratic Party and potentially in the Republican primary as well. When you have people coming out and high quality people, that's a sign that they sense the election is winnable. And so it's a way to sort of see through this revealed behavior how people are thinking about the strength of a Trump candidacy in 2020. So I think the first thing we learn is that there are a lot of people, perhaps on both sides, who think that the president's coalition is cracking. So that's one thing. Now, there's a difference in the quality of candidates we've seen so far emerge on the left and on the right within the Republican Party. So I don't want to get too excited about what's going to happen in that Republican primary. And Lonnie may be a better person to ask about this. But the fact that people are thinking about it and talking about it this morning, John Kasich, same thing, said, I'm not sure. I'm not going to rule anything out. Those are all, I think, indicators that people think that Trump's strength in the party is weakening.
Lonnie Chen with the Hoover Institution at Stanford, your take, what if a John Kasich or a Jeff Flake or somebody of that caliber starts to make real noises about getting in 2020?
Well, I think there's a little bit of a chicken and egg issue here. You've got a number of Republicans that have been rumored to want to challenge the president in a primary, but I doubt that any person of serious substance will want to do it unless they perceive a real chance to knock the president off. I don't think you're going to see too many folks of very high caliber do it just to do it, just to make a point. I'm sure someone will, regardless. Someone will, because there is a marketplace for that kind of candidate. That having been said, I think that you know, there's a lot to happen between now and when the primaries get going next year. Certainly with the Mueller investigation, we'll see how the president's handling of the economy goes. Obviously, the economy, if you ask a lot of folks who follow this closely, is teetering on the edge of slowing down pretty significantly, which I think would affect the president's prospects. And then, of course, you have anything else that could happen abroad, whether it's the chaos in Venezuela or what we continue to see in the Middle East. You know, all of these factors could affect who ends up deciding to run. But at this point, I have a very difficult time seeing any serious candidate entertain the notion of challenging the president in a primary, because he still does have significant popularity with his base. Now, it's not completely baked in yet, but we're starting to get to the point now where I think we'll want to observe this pretty closely.
Speaking of serious candidates, as Lonnie Chen just mentioned, we are going to talk coming up next about Kamala Harris, the California senator, jumping in with a big campaign rally in Oakland. A lot more coming up on our Politics Roundtable here on Air Talk. I'm Libby Denkman in for Larry Mantle. We're going to be right back after this news break with Hedy Lyn Hurdies. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Libby Denkman in for Larry today. Lonnie Chen is on the line with me, research fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University. He was an advisor for Marco Rubio's 2016 presidential campaign. And Lynn Vavrick is also here, professor of political science at UCLA. And we are in the middle of our politics roundtable for Air Talk, our weekly look at the world of politics. And the biggest news out of the weekend, other than the government shutdown ending, was, of course, Kamala Harris beginning her presidential campaign. The California senator's big campaign launch in Oakland brought out thousands of supporters. She talked about her parents' immigrant story, her roots in Oakland. She quoted Bob Marley, and she called the president's wall a, quote, medieval vanity project. As you might expect, Kamala Harris made a case for herself as a 2020 presidential contender.
And so, I stand before you today clear-eyed about the fight ahead and what has to be done. With faith in God, with fidelity to country, and with the fighting spirit I got from my mother, I stand before you today to announce my candidacy for President of the United States.
So Lonnie Chen, she raised a lot of issues in her speech. Medicare for all, universal pre-K, debt-free college, a major tax cut for the middle class, a pathway to citizenship for undocumented immigrants. And she also took a swing at the Republican tax plan, saying it was a giveaway to corporations. Anything you're unique that you're seeing out of the Kamala Harris campaign so far, or out of the policy proposals that she's putting forward?
Well, let's be clear. It was a great launch for Senator Harris. I mean, it was a great week for her. It was very well done by her team, very well orchestrated. I've been at the start of many presidential campaigns, and the challenge is always you only have down to go after a launch week, and so we'll see where her campaign goes. But in terms of the policy she's outlined, I think it's very obvious that she is trying to appeal to the base of the Democratic Party, the progressive activists that she believes will show up in primary elections in states like Iowa and South Carolina and New Hampshire once we get to 2020. It'll be interesting to see where her differentiation is. This is always the challenge in a primary campaign when you're fighting over a narrow strip of turf. And this is the case whether it's a Republican primary or Democratic primary. You have to draw distinctions on very, very narrow sets of issues. So, for example, will she embrace Medicare for all, to the contrast of other Democrats who might say we're for a public option but not necessarily for entirely replacing our existing health care system? Will she be to the right of someone like Elizabeth Warren, who's proposed a wealth tax? You know, so these are all interesting questions we'll have to see as time goes on. But what you're going to see these primary candidates try to do is, even if they're articulating very similar policies or in fact the same policy, they may talk about it differently. They may try to express that difference so that voters can draw distinctions in what is a very crowded field.
You know, last year, Lonnie, I was hearing Kamala Harris's camp talking about this big policy proposal called the LIFT Act. It was almost like a universal basic income, $250 per month for single people within a certain income range. So basically a boost for the middle class. And it would be paid for by, according to the Harris camp, reversing the tax overhaul that the Republicans passed last year. I didn't really hear much specifically about the LIFT Act in her rollout, and I don't know if they're moving away from that or if that's just something that didn't have space in this speech. Do you think that Harris is competing, you know, in terms of big ideas with candidates like Elizabeth Warren, or even though she's not going to be on the ballot, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who's really capturing imaginations with, like, the Green New Deal?
Yeah, you know, she is going to need a signature policy proposal. I think every candidate needs one of those. And I think she this proposal you're referring to essentially was a massive expansion of the earned income tax credit. It would have given essentially certain payments to folks if they were working, targeted toward the middle class, obviously. And I think that one of the reasons why they may be shying away from it is not so much shying away from it as trying to figure out exactly what they want to do with it, you know, because initially a lot of commentators characterized it as you did, which was a creation of some kind of universal basic income policy, which they were resistant to that characterization of. And then there was some confusion about exactly how the policy would work. So maybe they're trying to refine it as they go forward. But there's no question that this would serve as a major area of differentiation from, let's say, Elizabeth Warren or even Kirsten Gillibrand, the senator from New York, who's also running for president. It'd be interesting to see kind of how she ends up distinguishing it. But so far, at least, you're right. They didn't spend too much time talking about it.
Yeah, that's Lonnie Chen with the Hoover Institution at Stanford. Lynn Vavrick, also here, professor of political science at UCLA. What are you hearing in terms of that rollout so far from Kamala Harris, Professor Vavrick, and her policy proposals, kind of the lane she's trying to stake out within this Democratic field?
Well, I agree with Lonnie that this was about as good as it can get for a rollout. The rally looked like a presidential campaign rally, you know, being done at the highest level. The crowd, the flags, even the sunshine capitulated, you know, sun shining down on her.
It was a really nice day in Oakland, you could tell.
you can't do any better than that. What I think is interesting about what she has done in the last, let's say, month, in writing this book, in talking on a lot of interview shows about the book and who she is, and then in this speech yesterday, she had. So Lonnie said that every candidate needs a distinguishing policy. And I want to edit that just a tiny bit to say an idea, a distinguishing idea. And if you can think that that's maybe John Kennedy in 1960 talking about the quote-unquote new frontier of the 1960s, or Ronald Reagan's Morning Again in America, not just about jobs, but about a lot of things. And I think Kamala Harris is onto something like that here, where she said yesterday, who are we? And she said it a number of times, who are we? And she means we as in Americans. And so this is now picking up this same storyline that we've been talking about all hour. What does it mean to be an American in this moment in time? And by writing this book and talking about who she is and what her identity is and where her political values come from and how she learned what it means to be an American, she then juxtaposes that with this broader question for everyone. Who are we? Who are you? And how do you come to your values? And how do you think about it? And I think if that's going to be the structure of her messaging and her campaign, I think she could own that idea in the Democratic primary, even as other candidates are more confrontational toward Donald Trump or tapping more into the progressive base. She could find herself really in a niche there that ends up looking like a real counter to what's happening in the White House.
I mean, she has this centrist criminal justice background. I've heard it called kind of the dream background for a Democrat to pull in swing voters, because she was a prosecutor, she was the attorney general, she has a lot of criminal justice accomplishments to point to in California. But at the same time, she has this criticism from the left and from progressives, especially in the Bay Area, for what she did as San Francisco district attorney and her AG job. You know, she didn't get on board with sentencing reform like Prop 47 in California, the measure that reduced some nonviolent felonies to misdemeanors. Other progressive goals, she's already had some op-eds written about her. Lynn, how does she unite Democrats if there is just this spirit right now of a really progressive, far-reaching left policies, but she's really a centrist, at least has a centrist background in terms of policy?
So I think thinking about something Lonnie said, that from that moment of the announcement, you know, there's nowhere to go but down. And what candidates want is to continue, of course, rising, maintain what they have and build on it. All candidates are constrained by their policy positions in the past, the things they've said, their ideas, who they actually are. All those things are constraints, and they look different. The constraints look different depending on who's standing next to you. And of course, there are going to be people to Harris's left. So she will have this constraint to worry about. But what we also know about successful candidates is they are often able to message around their constraints in very successful ways, especially if their ship is sailing swiftly, right? If the tide is rising for them. So she could take all of this stuff that sounds like a constraint and turn it into a strength and say, listen, you know, yes, I made all those choices, but these are hard questions and hard problems, and we want to solve them and we want to make progress. And I've been in the trenches, and I know these policy areas and these decisions, what it takes to make them, better than anyone, because I've been there and I know how hard it is. And that's why you want me in there again, because I've got all this experience and I know it's difficult. Something like that. I mean, this is not what I do for a living. A professional will be better at it than me.
You're providing the consultation for the Harris campaign. I can hear it already. They're going to be calling you, Lynn.
Surely not. They should not.
Lonnie Chen is also here. Lonnie, what do you make of how Harris will have to contend with her criminal justice history when the mood in the country really is swinging to sentencing reform, to looking at the way we treat black and brown people in the criminal justice system? It reminds me, it reflects what Joe Biden will have to also contend with, a lot of his history on this issue. How will Harris be able to contend with it, or will she really suffer in terms of not being able to capture progressives?
Yeah, I'm not sure she's going to suffer too much, in part because her experience, you know, the candidates that are good candidates are able to turn problematic elements of their experience and their background into advantages. And in her case, she has seemed very adept, at least if you look at the accounts of her political past, she's been very adept at turning things that might be seen as liabilities into strengths. There was a famous profile, I forgot where it was, maybe it was Politico, that was written on her, where she essentially turned this fact that she had dated Willie Brown before into a spear that she could use against her male opponents when she first ran for District Attorney of San Francisco many years ago. And this is different, obviously. This is not a personal trait. This is a policy question, really, kind of how you deal with criminal justice issues given the background that she has.
But the jujitsu of that, kind of taking your criticism and using it against your opponent, is a similar vibe, is what I'm hearing you say.
Yeah, and I think she's proven an ability to do that. And so I wouldn't be particularly concerned about that if I were her. I mean, obviously it's a matter of concern. I think the bigger question continues to be, where is that differentiation going to come from in a field of 30, 40 candidates when there are arguably people occupying a similar lane to her? Is she going to distinguish on biography? Is she going to distinguish on a big policy idea? What is it that she's going to distinguish on? And I think that question, we'll have to see how it goes as the campaign goes on and the tactic that the campaign ends up choosing to adopt.
30 or 40 candidates, when you said those words, Lonnie, I just kind of, you know, my eyes glazed over. This is going to be a long year and a half. Lonnie Chen is research fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University, and Lynn Vavreck is professor of political science at UCLA. Back in 1 minute to talk about the rest of the 2020 field, because it is widening. An unexpected, perhaps independent candidate getting in the race. What will that mean for the Democratic Party? I'm Libby Denkman in for Larry Mantle. Back after this short break. It's the Politics Roundtable on Air Talk every Monday here on 89.3 KVCC. I'm Libby Denkman in for Larry Mantle. We are looking at the 2020 field because yesterday it widened by one more potential candidate. Former Starbucks CEO Howard Schultz says he is seriously considering an independent run for president. He went on 60 Minutes to talk about it.
I am seriously thinking of running for president. I will run as a centrist independent outside of the two-party system. We're living at a most fragile time. Not only the fact that this president is not qualified to be the president, but the fact that both parties are consistently not doing what's necessary on behalf of the American people and are engaged every single day in revenge politics.
So Howard Schultz also spoke really emotionally with Scott Pelley in this interview about abuse that he suffered at the hands of his father. He really was talking about his biography. He even got behind the espresso machine to make Pelley a mocha or something. I mean, he was really rolling up his sleeves and showing he was a regular guy. Lynn Vavreck with UCLA, do voters want to have a cup of coffee with their candidates or a beer? And is Howard Schultz somebody that we should take seriously here as he enters the 2020 field?
Well, there's a lot to talk about on this topic, but on this question of having a beer or having a coffee, you know, I'm of two minds on this. On the one hand, I love that candidates understand that they have to connect with voters beyond just their policy positions, that they understand that there's a component to this relationship between our agent who we're sending to write laws that are going to affect us, you know, and who we are. That relationship has to be about more than just the policy ideas. I like that candidates get that. On the other hand, I don't love the, you know, oh, hi, you're in my kitchen, I'm shooting a video, I'm going to grab me a beer.
The Elizabeth Warren move.
You know, yes. It just feels very unnatural to me. Let me get up and walk behind this espresso maker and make you a coffee. I don't know. I think it's obviously more effective when it happens naturally. And that's, you know, that authenticity is what they're trying to convey. But when they stage it so much, it's obviously no longer authentic.
Yeah, it feels it rings false for sure. But what about, I mean, Democrats right now have to just be shaking their heads because Schultz is a lifelong Democrat. He said at the start of this interview, he has over $3 billion in net worth. So he's very able to fund his own independent run. But most of his policies, I mean, he's called out President Trump on climate change. He wants a path to citizenship. He's in favor of access to health care for every American, not universal, but access to quality health care. He's against the wall. I mean, these are not progressive, but they are definitely Democratic positions. He'll siphon votes from Democrats, right?
You know, I think it's hard to know if he would steal votes from either side. But he said two things in that interview yesterday that I think are important for everyone to think about. He said both or neither political party is doing what's necessary for the American people or something like that. And he said all they do is engage in revenge politics. And what's interesting about that to me as a political scientist is I don't know what he means by that. I don't know what he means when he says not doing what's necessary. I assume he means the act of governing. And then engaging in revenge politics, he's talking about just, you know, staking out positions that are so opposite from one another and trying to one-up one another. And a little bit I want to say, like, hey, newsflash, politics is about who gets what, how much, and why. And that's competition. And, you know, it's
similar to business, you
ever
would think.
So, you know, ever so. And if it feels like there's more revenge politics now, yes, maybe the rhetoric has been dialed up in Washington and people don't like that and this feels like a big exhale. But the parties are more homogenous now than they have been in many, many decades. And that is not because of Donald Trump. It is not because of Nancy Pelosi. People have just figured out that if you're liberal, you belong in the Democratic Party. And if you're more conservative, you belong in the Republican Party. That's been happening for decades, that change. And it's a moment where we are. Mm. So he's not going to change that.
Yeah, really quickly, I want to get Lonnie Chen's take. Lonnie, is this Ralph Nader 2000 redux?
Look, I don't think there's any question that Howard Schultz is going to harm Democrats. That's why you see Democrats attacking him the way that they are to try and help him realize that what he will do is siphon votes away from whoever the Democratic nominee is. This seems to me like a little bit of a vanity project, although if it were the case that he could really somehow figure out a set of campaign themes or a way of appealing to people that would break down divisions, I'd be all for it. I'm just skeptical that it's going to do anything more than boost Donald Trump's chances of being reelected in 2020.
I'm just curious, too, Lonnie. Schultz is arguing that 40% of the electorate are either registered independents or they affiliate themselves as an independent. I suppose he's referring to various surveys if they think of themselves as independent thinkers or voters. But we saw in the 2018 California election, even though no party preference voters now outnumber the Republican Party, most of those voters still break for a party, more for Democrats than Republicans. And we saw that in a few of the races where there was an independent candidate, like for insurance commissioner. Is this supposedly large pool of independent voters out there for the taking just a mirage?
I don't think it's a mirage in the sense that I think people are genuinely frustrated with the parties. But I think at the end of the day, there is something about the major party brands that people still gravitate toward. And so I do think people, I think you're absolutely right, they do tend to gravitate toward one of those two parties and end up casting their lot with one of them. But the question is how large of a population that is. And I just have a very difficult time seeing disaffected Republicans voting for Howard Schultz when it becomes clear what Howard Schultz has been for and the things that he's advocated for in his past. So that's why I tend to believe that his measure of support is going to come from Democrats who perhaps are maybe a little more business-minded if the Democrats nominate a left progressive candidate. I just have a very difficult time seeing how it doesn't work to the benefit of Donald Trump in the long run.
Yeah, last word for Lynn Vavrick of UCLA. Anything you want to add on Howard Schultz and what to expect out of an independent candidate?
Well, just that the reason independents don't deliver for that independent candidate like you just talked about is that There's no social identity. There's no psychological attachment to a group for an independent. And so they're just harder to sort of motivate into a collective action in the way that being a Democrat or being a Republican actually means something to the people who claim those labels.
And we're going to have to leave it there. Lynn Vavreck, professor of political science at UCLA. She tweets at Vavreck, V-A-V-R-E-C-K. And Lonnie Chen, research fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University. He tweets at L-A-N-H-E-E-C-H-E-N. Thanks to both of you for joining me on Air Talk. More coming up after this break. I'm Libby Denkman in for Larry Mantle.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering a doctorate of education in organizational leadership, developing graduates with the knowledge and ability to transform organizations for optimal success and growth, offering an online hybrid format in West LA with attendance only twice per term, tailored for working professionals. Classes start September. Apply by February 18th to be considered for a $3,000 scholarship opportunity at gsep.pepperdine.edu.
When an earthquake hits, you need to drop, cover, and hold on.
Definitely there will be the perception that the ground is literally waving in front of you.
But what do you do after the shaking stops? When the power is out, the roads are blocked. I'm Jacob Margolis, host of KPCC's new podcast, The Big One, your survival guide. And I've got plenty of answers for you. Listen in Apple Podcasts.
It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Thanks so much for being with me while Larry Mantle is away today. I'm Libby Denkman sitting in for him. We are going to talk later this hour about the etiquette of ghosting. That's cutting off contact with a loved one, a friend, somebody you're dating with no explanation why it happens. We're going to hear from people who do ghost and from people who have been ghosted. I'll be taking your calls later this hour. First up, though, the political strife in Venezuela may be coming to a flashpoint. President Nicolas Maduro was sworn in earlier this month for a second term, but the U.S. and at least a dozen other countries have recognized the country's opposition leader, Juan Guaido, as the interim president. Maduro initially called for U.S. diplomats to leave the country, though he backed off and allowed minimal staff to remain, while Guaido today called for more street demonstrations against Maduro. On Saturday, Venezuela's highest-ranking military official in D.C. broke with Maduro and encouraged the rest of the armed forces to do the same. The effects of this economic strife, like rampant inflation, have really devastated average Venezuelans, driving millions to leave the country and causing widespread hunger. So when is relief going to come for the people of Venezuela, and what's next in this geopolitical standoff? Joining me right now is Miguel Tinker Salas, professor of Latin American history and Chicano Latino studies at Pomona College. He's also written three books on Venezuela, including Venezuela, What Everyone Needs to Know. Professor Salas, thank you so much for being on Air Talk today.
Thank you. Good morning.
I just want to start out by getting a little background. Venezuela is an oil-producing state. It was once one of the wealthiest countries in its region. What happened? Was it simply oil prices taking a hit? What's behind this economic crisis of the last few years?
Well, oil is central to understanding the crisis in Venezuela. In fact, when Venezuela became, in 1935, the world's leading exporter of oil, it also became a net importer of food. That highlights the dependency that was created with the rise of the oil industry. The government depends from close to 95% of all revenue from oil, and it imports a great part of what it consumes. So that means that agriculture lagged. That means that other industries lagged. And more recently, the population has also increased. When Venezuela discovers oil, we're talking about 3.5 million people. Today, we're talking about 35 million. You add to that the dramatic changes that took place under Hugo Chavez, that is, the use of oil to fund social programs, and then very little money invested in the actual industry itself or the infrastructure. You add to that the decline in oil prices, sanctions, the social tumult, and you begin to to understand the context for the current crisis, adding, of course, corruption, inefficiency, and mismanagement.
Mm. Also on the line with us is Cynthia Arntzen, director of the Latin American program at the Wilson Center, and her research focuses include Latin American politics, democratic transition, and global governance in Venezuela. Cindy, what do you make of what's happening right now in Venezuela? Can you paint a picture for us right now of what it's like to be somebody living there and watching this political strife and economic collapse play out around them? What are normal people facing?
Sure. Well, Libby, I mean, as Miguel was saying, Venezuela represents, I think, the most severe economic and humanitarian crisis, arguably, that Latin America has ever seen. Inflation, conservatively, was estimated by the IMF to be about 1,000,000%. There are 3 million refugees that have fled Venezuela into other countries. Malnutrition and undernutrition is rampant. The healthcare system is in collapse. And this is, I think, what's behind or the main driver of this massive exodus of people. Right now, the political situation is incredibly unstable. You have a National Assembly, which was elected in elections that were held in December 2015, which has appointed a president who has now declared himself to be the president of Venezuela and has been recognized by the United States, a number of Latin American and European countries, not, of course, by China and Russia and Turkey and all Cuba, Nicaragua, other allies of the current regime.
Yeah. And I do want to get to Juan Guaido and his declaring himself the interim president. Just really quickly back to Professor Salas. When we look at Nicolas Maduro's tenure so far, he's just reelected under suspicious international watchers, we'll say, circumstances to another 6-year term. What has he done since taking over for President Hugo Chavez?
Well, unfortunately, the rise of Maduro parallels the dramatic decline in the price of oil. By 2015, the price of oil had begun the process of declining. And Venezuela has a unique situation. It has heavy crude deposits, which means that being able to process heavy crude, it has to import light crude, sometimes from Algeria, sometimes from the U.S. So that means it has to buy oil on the international market, bring it to Venezuela, mix it with heavy crude to be able to get a Mere formula for the sale of oil. That gets it at a very, very disadvantaged position so that it can always say it has the largest deposits of oil in the world, but heavy crude. That was one of the main problems why, again, the decline in the price of oil. And you have to add U.S. sanctions under Obama and then under Trump, which made it hard to get credit or to renegotiate the debt. And you have to also add the instability within the country. But again, Maduro has improvised the economy. Every step he takes has been a little bit too little too late, and he's proven incapable of actually projecting a long-term plan that can address the country's serious ills.
Back to Cindy Arntzen with the Latin American program at the Wilson Center. To Juan Guaido, the opposition leader. He is the new head of Venezuela's elected National Assembly, although that body doesn't really have much power. Who is Juan Guaido, and what direction does he propose taking Venezuela in?
Well, I think that the opposition to Maduro and before that to Hugo Chavez was looking to restore liberal democracy to Venezuela, which, of course, the regime, I think, was until the election of Hugo Chavez in 1998 and the subsequent erosion of checks and balances and the concentration of power in the hands of the executive and the really co-opting of institutions and the packing of things like the Supreme Court with Chavista supporters. So it's the opposition's claim and demand all along has been for a return to democracy. Now, Guaido has come out of nowhere in a lot of ways, although he has a long record within Venezuela as a student leader. He is a member of the assembly and was appointed. And I think one of the virtues that he has is that he is a totally fresh face. He does not come from the people that have ran against Nicolás Maduro or Hugo Chávez in the past, some of the leaders like Enrique Capriles or Leopoldo López, who remains under house arrest. And it served to just give enormous hope to Venezuelans who thought that after the basically the fraudulent elections of last May and the now re-inauguration of Maduro, that this regime was going to consolidate. So this was really thrown a curveball, and you can see by the tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people that have taken to the streets that there is enormous enthusiasm, but also a great deal of uncertainty, among other things, about how the armed forces will react, whether they will unleash waves of repression once again, whether there are cracks, whether there has been so much corruption in the armed forces that people will remain loyal to Maduro. Just as a final point, the opposition has been very, very, I think, savvy in publicizing an amnesty for members of the armed force,
right,
which sides. And that's been, I think, psychologically a very important.
And they're passing out these pamphlets to military members that they see in the streets, that saying that they will have amnesty if they decide to stop backing Maduro. Really quickly, Cindy, why has the opposition leader, Juan Guaido, not been arrested the way Leopoldo Lopez was?
I think some of it has to do with the extraordinary level of international support that Guaido has, and whether this would just spark a total uprising within the country. I think that given the recognition of the U.S. government, I mean, the government now, Guaido has his own ambassador to the White House. I mean, this is just an extraordinary diplomatic time, and the cost internationally of taking such a measure like that, which is not impossible, but I think increasingly unlikely, is because of this outpouring of international recognition for the Venezuelan opposition, symbolized in this figurehead of a new interim president.
That's Cindy Arnson with the Wilson Center. Also on the line is Miguel Tinker Salas, professor of Latin American history and Chicano Latino studies at Pomona College. At this point, Professor Salas, Russia and China supporting Maduro, whereas most Western powers are aligning with Guaido. Is this a proxy struggle for the future of Latin America, just like we saw in the Cold War?
There are elements of it, no doubt. But I think that the larger question that really faces Venezuela is how to find a agreement. I think that the only solution has to be some negotiated process. Otherwise, we're back to square one tomorrow. The reality is, unless there's a consensus of how any kind of process of transition or moving forward, because the Chavistas are not going to disappear, and neither is the opposition. So the reality is that we need to, like was done in El Salvador, like was done in Guatemala, like was done in Colombia, there has to be some form of negotiations in which everyone recognizes the existence of the other. Venezuela has changed. There's no going back to 1998. There's no going back to what it was before. We're talking about a dramatically changed country, whether we agree with it or not. To me, that's not the issue. The issue is, how do we constitute some sort of political arrangement that can only come through dialogue? We have to avoid violence. We have to avoid intervention, because intervention has not gone well elsewhere in Latin America or the rest of the world. So I think the fundamental issue for me is, how do we create the context in which there can be that kind of negotiation? Mexico and Ecuador have agreed to serve as negotiators. So has the UN. The president of the UN calling for negotiations. So I think that to me is the only way forward.
Miguel Guaido told the Washington Post that he's in talks with military leadership behind the scenes to force Maduro out. How likely is that to succeed? What do you sense is the support for Maduro still within the military?
Undoubtedly, within the hierarchy of the military, Maduro counts on support. They not only are in key economic positions, in key government positions, they also share the power with Maduro. So that if there are any cracks, I'm very clear on this, why those actions were in fact seeking to see if there were fissures or cracks within the military. That's a dangerous strategy because, again, two factions in the military fighting each other could easily plunge the country into a civil war. So I'm very cautious about what that implies in terms of utilizing the military to oust Maduro or to force Maduro's ouster, because, again, that would put us back to square one. It doesn't provide the consensus, the basis of discussion for how we go forward as a country, other than simply an eye for an eye. And in that context, everyone winds up blind.
I'm curious, Cindy Arnson, we're hearing from you that the support from the U.S. and other international powers for Juan Guaido is helping to protect him and maybe helping to allow the opposition to flourish. At the same time, though, isn't any sense that there are American fingers in the political system of Venezuela just, you know, giving flashbacks of a terrible time in Latin American history when interventions were very violent and very damaging for that region? Is international attention and political intervention, not military intervention even, playing out domestically in a damaging way for the opposition?
Well, I think that, you know, raising the specter of U.S. imperialism and U.S. intervention has long been a card used not only by Hugo Chavez, but also by Nicolas Maduro to point to all of the signs of discontent and all of the problems that Venezuela has as a result of the meddling by the United States and to a lesser extent other powers. I don't think that that is as convincing to Venezuelan citizens at this point. I think that there's a pretty broad recognition of who bears responsibility for the economic and humanitarian and social collapse of the country. And I would suspect, having not been in Caracas in the last week, but I would suspect that a lot of people are quite relieved to see the level of international support for the democratically elected National Assembly. And we have to remember that the last time that there were elections that were not free and fair, but at least more free and fair than the ones that have taken place subsequently, the opposition won 2/3 of the assembly. It was denied a couple of seats, which kept it shy of that 2/3 mandate, which would have allowed it to make a number of changes under the Venezuelan constitution. But the Venezuelan government under Maduro has responded by simply disbanding or saying that the National Assembly does not have power and convening an alternative constituent assembly. So to the extent that there is electoral legitimacy and democratic legitimacy in the country, it is in the National Assembly. And I agree with Miguel that Chavismo is part of the country and part of the fabric of the country. But unlike previous instances of dialogue or negotiation, this is not really a question of whether Maduro goes or what are the terms for new elections. It's a question of when he goes and how this transition is to take place in an orderly fashion. I'm not convinced that Mexico is necessarily well-placed to lead that, along with Uruguay. I think countries of the Lima Group, which represent the vast majority of the population of Latin America, have to be part of that discussion. Mexico, under President López Obrador, has adopted quite anachronistic position of non-intervention.
What other countries are in the Lima Group, Cindy, just to let our audience know?
Well, Argentina, Chile, Colombia, the major, major democracies of the region that by far constitute the bulk of the population of the Western Hemisphere.
Miguel Tinker-Sales, also on the line. What do you think about the way this is going to be resolved? Just to wrap up here, when could new elections be held if a transition of power happens? And how do you expect this to go forward?
Well, the Constitution says that whenever there's a new transition of power, it's 30 days. So the election would have to be in 30 days, except I would just be cautious about what that all implies, because there are many protests in Venezuela, but no one is protesting because they want an end to the many of the social programs they've received, which are free education, subsidized housing, food, etc. So there are many different kinds of protests in Venezuela, and it's difficult to lump them all together. They may be critical of Maduro, but none of them are saying we want to give up on many of the social programs that we have received and benefited from in the last 18 years. And that puts a different kind of take on the process in Venezuela. And just to add on the Lima Group is rather belligerent. We're talking about Bolsonaro in Brazil.
Right, very far-right-wing president.
Far-right-wing neo-fascist talking about overthrowing Venezuela. Same thing with Mr. Duque, Iván Duque. So again, there is a little bit of saber rattling, and putting Elliot Abrams in charge of Venezuelan policy really does not do the U.S. any good as well.
Miguel Tinker-Sales, professor of Latin American history and Chicano Latino studies at Pomona College, and Cindy Arnson, director of the Latin American program at the Wilson Center. Thank you both for joining me on Air Talk today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Pleasure.
Coming up next, we're going to tackle a program of soft power by China in U.S. universities across the country. Some U.S. officials are now saying they could be hotbeds of espionage. We'll look into it coming up next on Air Talk. I'm Libby Denkman, in for Larry Mantle today. Back after this short break. It's 89.3 KBCC. This is Air Talk. I'm Libby Denkman, in for Larry Mantle while he takes the day off. We're moving on to a discussion about soft power by foreign governments in the U.S. A recent article in the L.A. Times shed some light on 100 Chinese cultural centers known as Confucius Institutes that have opened on college campuses across the country. They include Stanford and UCLA. These nonprofit centers are meant to present a positive image of Chinese art and language, and they sound like places for the kind of international exchange of ideas that's usually encouraged at universities. But with rising economic and political tensions between the U.S. and China, Confucius Institutes are suddenly under a microscope. Some American officials say they fear the centers may be undermining academic independence or even promoting espionage. So what's really going on at Confucius Institutes? We have the author of that article I mentioned, Don Lee, reporter for the L.A. Times, who was formerly the L.A. Times Shanghai Bureau Chief. Don Lee's on the line with me now. Welcome so much, and thank you for being on Air Talk.
Hi, Libby. Thanks for having me on.
Also on the line is Clayton Doobie, director of the USC U.S. China Institute. Welcome, Clay. Thank you for being here.
To be here. Thank you, Libby.
So I just want to start really quick with Don Lee, because when I first heard of this program, the Confucius Institute program at different universities across the U.S., I don't believe that my school, the University of Washington in Seattle, had one of these. I don't recall seeing it on campus or knowing about anything to do with the Confucius Institute. So I feel like a lot of our audience is in the same boat. Can you describe what are Confucius Institutes?
Sure. As you observed, you know, these are fairly low-key, and so people probably, even on campuses where there are Confucius Institutes, probably don't even know that they exist there. But they've quietly popped up over the last 15 years, starting with the University of Maryland in 2004. And these are programs that were conceived, established, and are funded by China's central government. And they're programs meant to promote the study of Chinese language and culture. And as you, you know, said in the introduction, they're also meant to be soft power vehicles where China can promote you know, positive image of the Chinese culture and other aspects.
Sure. So are they like physical buildings or are they clubs on campus? And who's working there?
Well, they're, the Confucius Institutes are, as I said, are funded by the Chinese government, the Ministry of Education, and they partner with sister universities. And so the American universities that host them would provide offices and also provide some funding. And the teachers and materials for teaching and the educational materials are provided by their Chinese counterparts. And so the U.S. Universities will have people, staff, and will support with their own sometimes faculty and other people, but these are largely driven by the Chinese government.
Hmm. Last year, FBI Director Christopher Wray said before a congressional panel that the FBI was keeping an eye on Confucius Institutes, and some lawmakers like Senator Marco Rubio of Florida have called on universities to end these agreements. What kind of concerns is Marco Rubio or other critics raising, Don Lee of the LA Times? What are they worried about when it comes to Confucius Institutes?
Well, I think we have to look at the Confucius Institute and the scrutiny that it's getting through the lens of the current U.S.-China relations. And, of course, you know, in the past when the U.S. was pursuing much more a policy of engagement with China. These programs, you know, people had questions about them, but they were generally seen as acceptable. But now we've entered a much more competitive and an adversarial relationship with China. And so both people in Congress as well as the administration are viewing these programs as well as other organizations and interactions with China with much more suspicion. And so I think that's the context in which Senator Rubio and others are questioning whether these centers that have outposts on American campuses, why they're there and whether they should be there and, you know, what the cost might be.
And to be clear, in your reporting, Don Lee with the LA Times, has there been any evidence that there is some type of nefarious activity going on with the Confucius Institutes or any evidence of any sort of espionage or spy activity related to these institutes?
My reporting has not turned up evidence of that, and I think people who have been following the Confucius Institute will say that there are, you know, questions, as you mentioned, about academic freedom or whether it might be compromising academic integrity by having a government program on its campus. But as far as being vehicles or hotbeds of intelligence gathering or espionage, I don't think there's been any credible evidence of that.
And in your reporting, I read in the LA Times that there was an incident like in Maryland where a speaker for Tibet issues was scheduled to come to the university, and the Confucius Institute, one of their representatives, encouraged Maryland to book another speaker to sort of counter what the Tibet individual was going to say. That's the kind of maybe influence that you saw in your reporting so far.
Yes, that's right. Whether it's the Dalai Lama or issues of, you know, Taiwan, or maybe there's discussion related to Chinese activities in the region. You know, you can think of the South China Sea and where China has been particularly aggressive. You know, people who are connected with the Confucius Institute, or if in this case in Maryland where it's very close to the Chinese embassy, I think they would be pushing against certain speakers, and they would want to present a counter-narrative and their version of these stories. And so I think that's the kind of influence and propaganda, if you will, that has taken place from time to time.
That's Don Lee, reporter for the LA Times, the former LA Times Shanghai bureau chief. He tweets at @DLEELATimes. Also on the line, Clayton Duby, director of the USC-US-China Institute. Clay, what do you make of Confucius Institutes and the new scrutiny that they're facing?
Well, Libby, I think what you and Don just discussed is entirely appropriate, that it is this headline attention to these issues comes as a consequence of the rising competition between the United States and China. The Confucius Institutes, as Don mentioned, have been around for 15 years. When they first came to the United States, government representatives came to various universities and said, can we give you some money to increase teaching about Chinese culture and language? And most universities said, no, thanks. But then what they did was mobilize universities in China to contact their academic partners. And that's what's happened in a number of cases, including at UCLA, at UC Santa Barbara, UC Davis, and some other places. And by the way, Libby, there is a Confucius Institute at the University of Washington.
There is. Okay. So it was so under the radar. It's also a gigantic university, so I, you know, could have missed it.
Well, that's right. And none of these places have dedicated buildings and that sort of thing. The amount of money that we're talking about, and this is something that Don has touched on in his articles, is relatively small. We're looking at maybe a startup grant of $100,000 to $200,000 to get things rolling, and then $100,000, $200,000, if you're fortunate, as UCLA has sometimes been, maybe $400,000 a year. And so in the grand scheme of things, this is not a huge sum of money. A place like UCLA, a place like USC, we have dozens of China specialists who are teaching classes all the time about China. And so this doesn't sway that. And so my general take is that anything that increases American understanding and American attention to China is generally a good thing. And these institutions should not be allowed to, of course, control discussion about China with regard to Tibet, with regard to Taiwan, with regard to Xinjiang, the million detainees, this sort of thing. They should not define the discussion, but they do help by bringing various programs to campus, in some cases by encouraging language instruction. Now, attention to this has come and gone. The last time there was a lot of American attention was maybe 10 years ago, and it was out in Hacienda Heights when they were creating a Confucius classroom. And the Confucius classrooms are the K through 12 partner of these Confucius Institutes.
Oh, they have this similar program for younger students.
It's different in the sense that in most cases it just involves providing books and video materials and things like that. In some cases, it does involve providing instructors. And so there are four LA Unified Chinese language instructors that are paid for and selected by the Chinese government. They've rotated through, and some other places have this as well. So it is going on at the K-12 level. With what Senator Rubio and others have been focused on with regard to these Confucius Institutes is they have the impression that they are defining what is said about China. And so in some instances, other programs that are funded by the federal government have not been permitted if a school takes Confucius Institute money. And most famously, this involves a federal government language initiative called StarTalk, where if you have a Confucius Institute, if the Confucius Institute would be the home of this money, the home of this federal program, that's a problem. And you couldn't apply. But as you found at the University of Washington, you know, these are sprawling programs. And for example, the Confucius Institute at Pittsburgh, University of Pittsburgh, it's helping to provide Chinese language instruction in western Pennsylvania, where there isn't a large population of Chinese Americans that are helping to facilitate that.
Yeah. Clay Dubey with USC. Just really quickly, Vice President Mike Pence said in October that Beijing was using organizations on campus to monitor students for anti-China speech or activities. Is there any fear, like the administration is suggesting, that organizations like the Confucius Institutes could be used in some kind of monitoring activity?
There may be some monitoring, but there's always this kind of monitoring. And so even if it doesn't happen by the Confucius Institute, we don't have one at USC, the Chinese authorities pay some attention to the kinds of programs that we have at this university and the kinds of activities that we have, the speakers we have, the subjects that we touch upon. So that they do pay attention to all discussions that they think may influence American perceptions of China.
Sure, sure. We've got a break right now, but Clay Dubey with USC's U.S.-China Institute, thanks to you, and Don Lee, reporter for the L.A. Times, covering national and global economic issues. Thank you both for discussing the Confucius Institutes, something that I had never heard of before, but are increasingly coming under a microscope from some lawmakers. Thanks very much, both of you, for joining Air Talk. And it's Libby Denkman in for Larry Mantle today. Coming up, something that I know a lot of folks out there are guilty of. I may be one of them. Ghosting. Why people do it and its psychological impact. I want to get your calls. If you are a ghoster, you've cut off contact with somebody that you are friends with or you've been dating with no explanation, or if you have been ghosted, 866-893-5722 to weigh in on this topic. That's 866-893-5722. We'll talk about the psychological impacts coming up next on 89.3 KBCC. Hey there, it's Air Talk on 89.3 KBCC. I'm Libby Denkman, sitting in while Larry Mantle takes the day off today. He'll be back tomorrow. Thanks for sticking with us. For the rest of this hour, we're going to talk about a terrible social behavior that a lot of us are guilty of. Here it is. Instead of having an uncomfortable conversation with a friend or an acquaintance, even someone you're dating, you simply cut off communication with no explanation. It's called ghosting. Now, maybe this was occurring long before my generation, the millennials, came around, and I have a feeling that it was. But the term appears to have been popularized in recent years, especially with online dating and digital communication making it easier to ignore friends and romantic partners and, you know, texts and emails, that kind of thing. But it turns out ghosting has psychological consequences, and I want to hear from you on this. If you have a friendship or a relationship that ended this way, give us a call, 866-893-5722. Or if you were on the other side, if you have ghosted people, now is the time to fess up and explain why you did it. 866-893-5722 is the number here. And I have a couple of guests to tackle this issue. Ebony Utley is a professor of communication studies at California State University, Long Beach. Thank you, Ebony, for being on Air Talk today. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thanks for having me.
And Courtney Warren is a clinical psychologist, adjunct professor of psychology at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, and adjunct clinical professor of psychiatry at the University of Nevada School of Medicine. Thank you, Courtney, very much for joining the show today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So first up, Courtney, how do you define ghosting? In your, I've kind of given a little bit of an intro here and defined it in my terms, but what is your take on what this behavior is?
Essentially, it's any time you end a relationship by cutting off communication. So going through a bad breakup, and instead of actually having a conversation about the breakup, you just stop returning phone calls. You just absolutely vanish, which is really the idea of a ghost, right? You turn into a ghost. The person can't find you. They have no information from you about why you have left their life. And it could be a friendship as well, but often we're talking about this in the context of romantic relationships.
Why do people do this? I mean, I have to say, I'm going to admit that I have participated in this behavior a couple of times over my years, not just in romantic relationships, but with a friend that I can think of when I moved away from where this friend was living. But why is it? I think back to my own behavior and think, why did I choose to do that? Why didn't I just have that conversation?
It's such a good question, and there are so many reasons that people ghost, but I think a couple of the most common would be that, first of all, breakups or ending any relationship, even if it's a friendship, is really, really hard, and it can be incredibly painful to have deep, intimate, vulnerable conversations with another person about why you're struggling to have them in your life. If it's a romantic relationship, oftentimes we're thinking we don't want to hurt their feelings. We don't want to say, you know what, I'm really just not that into you, or I'm not really in a place where I want to have a relationship with you, or maybe I'm not even attracted to you, right? Like some of those really rough, honest conversations, we would much rather just kind of leave because it's easier, and then we don't have to confront the truth with that other person.
So it's cowardice.
Another
is what you're
really,
saying, Courtney.
Yes,
it's just
a lot of times
I'm being a wimp.
It's cowardice. It is an insecurity because it's just so uncomfortable. You really don't want to be in that position. The other big reason people will say is that they're afraid of the other person's reaction. So sometimes you might be in a situation where you've learned something about a friend or someone you're dating, and you say to yourself, oh my gosh, I don't trust you. I'm afraid of you. This isn't good. And if I actually tell you the truth, I don't think you're going to react well. And so they'll just vacate. Those are two really big reasons people do it.
Yeah. Ebony Utley also on the line. Ebony, is this a new behavior, or are we just sort of recognizing it more clearly as a defined behavior nowadays? Has this been around for a while, ghosting?
I don't think it's a new behavior, but it's definitely been augmented by the technology. It's so much easier to disappear if your relationship is primarily mediated and if you don't live in the same geographical space. In Los Angeles, it's very easy to sort of disappear in the morass that's Los Angeles and not run into someone physically again. So, I mean, I think we've had other behaviors like stonewalling and ostracism that have been very popular in relationships where the other person just won't give you the communication that you're asking for. So that part has been around for a long time, but ghosting definitely takes it up a notch by completely disappearing from the relationship.
Yeah, I want to get some calls on the line, and you can join us at 866-893-5722, 866-893-5722, to talk about your experience. So far, we only have people who have been ghosted. And I really want to hear from people who have done this behavior. Don't ghost me on Air Talk right now. Give us a call, 866-893-5722. All are welcome. And Valerie from Monrovia is on the line right now. Hi, Valerie. So you have had this happen to you. You've been ghosted. What are your observations?
Yeah, I have several observations to make. I think one of the things that's really difficult about it is how unilateral it is. It's that the other person has made this decision that they no longer want to be in your life or have you in theirs. And so they simply make the decision for the both of you and disappear. And I think also that it shows a tremendous lack of respect for the person's humanity. I mean, I don't care how hard it is to do. It's just wrong to treat someone that way. It's not respectful. It's saying you're just not worth it for me to put myself out.
Yeah. Valerie, can I ask what situation you were ghosted in? Because I can hear the emotion in your voice, and it seems like it's kind of raw.
A girlfriend that I went to high school with. I'm 68 now, so we'd known one another many, many years. And she simply started ignoring me and lived in another town and just stopped returning my calls. Oh. And I think she finally sent a text. And I kept texting her. I mean, it took a while for me to accept it, you know, that I was being ignored.
Yeah.
So it is it's very hurtful. It's unfair feeling. You know?
Yeah, Valerie, thank you very much for your call. And I'm so sorry that that happened to you, because I can tell that it still, you know, somebody you've known for so long, and that unexplained cutoff of communication, it can hurt so badly. And I hear that in your voice. And I really thank you for sharing. Michael is on the line in Alhambra. And Michael actually has been the ghoster. So we're going to get to him in just one second. We have to take a very quick break. It's Libby Denkman in for Larry Mantle, talking about ghosting and your behavior of cutting off communication or having communication cut off from you without explanation. 866-893-5722 to share your story. Back after this break. Back with more Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC, talking about ghosting and how it affects people psychologically. Getting your calls on being ghosted or doing the ghosting. And Michael in Alhambra is on the line. And you ghosted two of your guy friends, Michael. Why did you do that? And what was the circumstances? What were the circumstances?
Yeah, it may sound kind of funny, but I'm a guy. And basically, I didn't like the way that they were treating women. And some of the stories that they were telling me about the women that they were dating, I think they thought, I don't know, I think they thought it would be all right. But it just spoke to their character. And I couldn't have people like that in my life.
So you felt like that wasn't a conversation you wanted to have with them. It was just kind of, you know, I'm going to distance myself and ghost.
Yeah, their behavior. I can't have people like that who treat other people like that. In my life, it just bothered me, you know.
Yeah. And so you cut it off, and I'm wondering how they felt on the other side. And I want to turn to Courtney S. Warren, a clinical psychologist at the University of Nevada. What do you think about the effects of ghosting on the other person? Psychologically, how does it feel if you have a friend or a loved one that does that?
Much like your callers have alluded to, many people who are ghosted experience that as incredibly violating. It feels very disrespectful, and it leads them with no closure or information about why the relationship ended. And there's something about that psychologically for most humans, that when you don't have information, it makes us incredibly anxious, and it can make us incredibly angry, because even though it would be really hard for any of us to bring forth hard information, painful information to someone that we're in a relationship with and say, this isn't okay with me. Hey, the way you're talking about the women in your life isn't okay with me. Or this thing about you, I really don't like. The reality is that we do a lot better when we hear the truth than when someone doesn't give us the information.
Even when it hurts. So just really quickly, I wanted to get the next caller on the line. Lucas in Huntington Beach is with us because, you know, Lucas, you're sort of the example of that feeling of being ghosted. You had a relationship end this way where you felt like you were ghosted. What happened?
So basically, I was all of a sudden one day my best friend came to me and told me he had feelings for me. It was all very dramatic. And then we started dating. And after everything kind of fell apart, after like 6 or 7 months, we stopped dating, ended the relationship. And when I tried to have an open form of communication, because he was someone who was so important to me, all of a sudden it was like there was no one there. And I didn't know what was going on. I didn't know what I had done. And it kind of left me with this weird sense of worthlessness and like I wasn't worth it. I wasn't worth being a part of his life anymore.
Well, you know, that wasn't true, though, Lucas, right? That was more about him being scared to talk to you, as we've been hearing from our psychologist this hour. It didn't have any bearing on your worth as a person, certainly. But I know that's hard to understand when you're in the throes of it.
Oh, yeah, exactly. That was like a main thing. Like, I mean, now looking back on it, it's been like 5 or 6 months and that happened. In the moment, it was like, it's all my fault. What did I do? But looking back on it, I could see that like he wasn't at that emotionally vulnerable place where he could say that he was hurting and that he was missing me. And so instead of saying like, I miss you, he just said, I'm going to pretend like you don't even exist. And then, you know, it made me realize that people who I have ghosted in my life, who I wish I could apologize to them.
Oh, so you've been on the other side of it. That's interesting, Lucas. And I just want to thank you for your call because we are going to move on. But Lucas, thanks so much for being vulnerable yourself today and sharing that story, especially because you've been a ghostie and a ghoster. Mark in Westwood is here. And Mark, I hear that this is a pattern for you.
Yeah, Libby, I've been ghosted and I'm a habitual ghoster. And
why, Mark? Why?
Well, relating to your clinical psychologist, the way she's describing exiting a relationship, it's almost akin to like an HR exit survey. I've never had it where you can actually have an honest conversation about the things that you don't like and the person to kind of take notes on how to improve in the future. It's always person gets upset or becomes defensive or projects, and I'll be honest, there's a certain amount of cowardice in ghosting. But when I've been ghosted, yeah, it hurts. And I'm left to kind of surmise what, you know, perhaps might have been the things that caused the other person to do. It is painful. I get it.
But you like it better? You think it's a better outcome if you ghost than to have the unsatisfying conversation?
I've never had a relationship that I can remember exit where the person exited me, where I got kind of like an HR survey, so I knew what to do and improve in the future. I'm not trying to be funny or facetious.
Sure, sure. No, I hear you, Mark, and I think that that's an interesting take, that it's just you have not had a successful open conversation in a breakup, and so when you go through it, why not just cut off communication? Mark in Westwood, thank you very much for your call, and I want to go to Ebony Utley for your reaction to what Mark is saying. He doesn't think that the breakup conversation has ever been successful for him on either side, and so he's decided he's just not going to do it.
I agree. That's often the case. A lot of people want to have breakup conversations, but they end up having a patch-up conversation with someone who doesn't want to let them go. And sometimes it is easier, sometimes more efficient to ghost instead. And I think sometimes to Lucas's comment, we think, oh, ghosting is the worst thing that can happen. But you have to review the relationship and look and see if there were other prior infractions prior to the ghosting. Were there other behaviors that you felt were dismissive or disrespectful that maybe led up to this event that you didn't see previously?
So things that maybe could have portended the ghosting or maybe softened the blow when you think about a relationship ending and you think maybe it wasn't worth it after all. Is that what you're saying, Ebony?
Yes, and I absolutely think that it's okay to ghost an abuser. I'm going to go out on a limb here, but if someone is abusing you, they don't owe you an explanation. If it's physical, emotional, physical, I think in those instances, it's okay to disappear.
I think it's good to be clear on that for sure. Ebony Utley with Cal State University Long Beach and Courtney Warren, clinical psychologist at the University of Nevada. Thank you both for joining me today on Air Talk for our discussion of ghosting. A lot of good calls this hour, and thank you so much. And sorry to the folks that I couldn't get on the air. I'm Libby Denkman in for Larry Mantle just for today. Larry will be back tomorrow. Fresh Air is up next.